The clerk will call the docket. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Duncan Getchell for Babcock & Wilcox. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Ariva's theory of the case amounts to this proposition, that the parties intended to divide a nuclear service business from an ROTSG, design, manufacture, and sale business, but they failed to successfully execute that intent. That is, Ariva says this court should construe the license agreement, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 237, beginning at Joint Appendix 3524, that this court should read that agreement to read out of the contract Babcock & Wilcox reservation of the ROTSG business. This approach is contrary to first principles of contract construction. On the ROTSG contracts, Babcock & Wilcox is entitled to reversal and final judgment, and the value of those contracts accounts for over 90% of the verdict. Now, Ariva is wrong in its theory, because Ariva was denied the right to perform, quote, to the manufacture or manufacturing detailed design of heavy components, end quote, which includes ROTSG. Babcock & Wilcox retained all rights in the OTSG technology, not granted.
Counsel, may I interrupt with a question?
Sir.
With respect to assignment of error 3, that the use has to be at the plant, and the additional language in the first contract exclusion clause that the use be performed at the plant. Which of the contracts, of the 15 contracts on the verdict form, do you claim that the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law to show actual use physically at the plant?
We contend that there is no evidence of actual use at the plant except for the Duke Master Services contract, which was the first contract, and under the first contract provision, its royalty was prepaid in the amount of $250,000.
And that was the Duke contract nuclear steam generator inspection and maintenance services agreement?
On the verdict form, Your Honor, it is Duke contract nuclear steam generator inspection and maintenance services agreement, plaintiff's 220.
Okay.
It's page 361 of the joint appendix, the last entry on that page.
Now, which B&W company had that contract?
There was some work done by B&W NE on that contract, which raises an issue under their claim with respect to tortious misappropriation, which we try to explain that in our reply brief later. But
was BWNE the sole BMW company performing the services under that master contract?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, but I'm not, have to check. I don't trust my memory, but I don't think so.
All right, and think this through with me for a second. This verdict form and the theory of the case is that that contract, which is number 14 on the list, was breached. The royalty agreement was breached. Ariva's claim was that whoever the B&W company was that was performing the services, and it appears to be BWNE, breached the royalty agreement. Therefore, they're alleging, and actually got a jury verdict finding, that they were subject to the 2004 sublicense. You follow me?
I do follow you.
So it backdoors into the trade secrets claim, which I'm sure we'll get into later. But it seems anomalous to me that a party could come into court, plead, prove, and actually get a verdict holding that a particular entity is breaching a contract, and then later claim, no, they're not even, they have no rights under the contract because they're not a party to the contract.
I agree they would be totally contradictory.
Well, we'll circle back to that. Once again, though, the with respect to the non-service agreements, was there any evidence at trial that any of the alleged exclusive technology that Areva and its predecessors had rights to were used or performed at the plant?
There was no evidence of anybody from any BMW entity going to the plant sites. And so I would say there was no evidence of that. Now, it turns out that the preliminary question for, if you look on the verdict form, the first, the second, and the third entry, are the ROTSG contracts that account for 92% of the verdict. And you don't get to use at the site on those because of the reservation. Remember, the services sublicense agreement only applies to that which Areva already had under the license agreement, and because of the manufacturing reservation, they didn't have that. So those contracts, although there's no evidence of any activity on the site for them either, those contracts don't even set up the possibility of royalty.
So under the 91 license, the exemption under the 91 license for the coordination agreement changeouts, under your understanding of the case, exempts all of the ROTSGs from 1, 2, and 3 on the verdict form from even being within the exclusive use category.
Well, I would call the court's attention to, if you look at the license agreement, there was an absolute express denial of the right to perform the manufacturer or manufacturing detailed design of heavy components, which includes ROTSG.
When you say looking at the licensing agreement, would you please identify exactly which agreement you're talking about?
Yes.
The 1991?
No, the 1989.
The 89 as amended.
Which is number 237.
Okay.
Plaintiff's Exhibit 237. And that provision is found at the JA page 3562.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Was the 1989 restated in the 1991?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why are we talking about a contract that's been superseded by a restated contract?
It's just the way the parties have referred to it, the way I've referred to it in the litigation. It was restated in 1991. I think of it as 1989, but we're talking about 237.
Just making sure we're not talking past each other.
Right. But there's that express prohibition. And then with respect to heavy component functional design and component design, if you look on page JA3560, Areva had only non-exclusive rights, and BMW expressly retained rights of functional design for ROTSGs, for which the functional design is requested by the customer, which of course was true for all three contracts because the customer presented a contract for us to perform.
Counsel, is it your position that if there is a service component to one of the ROSTG contracts, that that falls outside of the licensing grant, that B&W would be entitled to do that without paying a royalty?
Yes, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is that there were rights that were exclusive to Areva under the license agreement. There were rights that were exclusive to B&W. And they were non-exclusive rights. And the right to manufacture, to design, manufacture, and sell ROTSGs, which was expressly forbidden to Areva, carried with it the right to do such engineering, functional engineering and component engineering, as was necessary to create an acceptable component.
So your position on the 400 hours of engineering support under the second contract, the first Energy Bessie, the first Energy Davis Bessie, would be something that B&W was entitled to do because it was an ROTSG?
Yes, Your Honor. And let me call your particular attention to B&W's rights of functional design, because they included, quote, and this is at JA 3529, quote, those design activities which establish the design parameters of the component and the specific applicable design requirements such as design codes, safety and quality levels, physical interfaces, working fluids, electrical requirements, and any other parameters needed to define the form, fit, and function of an acceptable component. So if we're dividing the businesses and we get the ROTSG business, and they're forbidden to do the ROST business, and we're given those rights of design, then anything that the Areva wishes to identify as being service design is not service design. It's within our exclusive field of use, not within their exclusive field of use. Now, on the contracts other than the Duke Master Services Agreement, and with respect to all the contracts other than the Hot Legs contract, which I'll talk about in a minute, we're dealing with small contracts which were not performed at the site. They were, if you look at them, they are, and look at the scope of work of them, they are kind of hypothetical engineering that wouldn't be done at the site. They're calculating what would happen in the event of failures. They're calculating what you'd have to do if there was a tube break. So they were small calculational contracts that didn't involve.
So your argument is the engineering was about the site, the engineering was concerning the site, but it wasn't performed at the site.
Those small contracts, the engineering had to do with the site because nobody would be buying anything. It didn't have anything to do with the site, but they weren't performed at the site. Unlike the commercial nuclear services, which Areva insists everything that they do doesn't have to be done at the site, but everything they do requires going to the site and doing things at the site if it's within their exclusive use. And so we believe that we do not owe royalty on these small contracts. But remember, they are very much the tail of the dog. The first three are where 92.2% of the money is.
Counsel, I have a couple of, I would say, clarifying questions. I have three questions. I'm going to ask the same questions of you that I will then ask of the appellee as well. Setting aside what's meant by things such as the term first contract and at OTSG sites, do you agree that the only things that B&W and B&W of Canada owe Areva a royalty on are the things that were licensed exclusively to Areva in the 1991 agreement?
Yes.
Okay.
And that doesn't get them home. That's just
trying to understand where the foundation is. Right. The superstructure is down the road. Second of all, do you agree that B&W Power Generating Group and B&W Nuclear Energy are not parties to the 2004 sub-license, so they can't do the things that B&W licensed exclusively to Areva in 1991?
I did not understand the question. I'm
okay. B&W Power Generating Group and B&W Nuclear Energy are not parties to the 2004 sublicense, correct?
I believe that by affiliation and being subsidiaries and so forth, if you read that agreement closely, the only entity that did anything with respect to these contracts that is not which Areva claims wasn't sublicensed was B&WNE.
Okay. Okay. My next question relates to the original license and the license amendment. So the original license, I'm referring to joint appendix, essentially pages 110 through 116. And the license amendment, I'm referring to joint appendix 8520, particularly paragraph 3 of it. Under paragraphs 8.2 C and D of the original license, that would be joint appendix page 116, and paragraph 3 of the license amendment, it's joint appendix 8520. The only rights that were licensed exclusively to Areva by B&W are those listed in 8.1, .1, A, B, and little I.
I don't have it in front of me. I can't do it from memory, but the big ones there for the first three contracts are C and D, and those are not exclusive. And B&W kept.
Why don't we do this quickly, if you will? Would you get Joint Appendix Volume 1?
Yes, I have.
Joint Appendix. Okay, page 116 is C and D. You know that by heart.
Yes.
Okay. Are the only rights that are licensed exclusively to Areva those listed on pages 110 and 111 as subparagraphs A, B, and I?
On page 110 of the joint appendix,
mm-hmm. 110 and 111.
A non-assignable irrevocable royalty-free license. They get with respect to I'm looking at a whole list of things, some of which are exclusive and some of which are non-exclusive.
That's my question.
And what is it that you're asking me?
Are the exclusive ones A, B, and I?
A, B, and I. I cannot answer that. I'll have to do it in rebuttal because I've looked at the contract a different way.
Okay, that would be fine.
All they have that's exclusive is commercial nuclear services.
And I don't want to take too much of your time, so doing it in rebuttal.
And then I'm down to two minutes and 14 seconds for rebuttal. I would go into the misappropriation of trade secrets claim. Areva's never been able to explain how a relationship completely defined by contract can give rise to the tort of misappropriation. They had no tort damages that they put on. We've discussed the BWNE, even if they were improperly performing work, they only did it on the due master services agreement, and no evidence of damages, value of use was presented on that.
Well, the thing I don't understand about that last point is BWNE was alleged to owe a contractual 4% royalty.
Barred by their own verdict.
Their whole pleading was that they were governed by the contract. Now they turn around saying they weren't.
I agree. They can't. Can I reserve? May I reserve my remaining time?
Yes, minute 19.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Peek. I am local counsel for Areva. At this time, I would like to introduce Mr. James Dabney, who has been admitted pro hoc vici, to argue the case on behalf of Areva.
Okay. Where are you from, Mr. Dabney?
Hughes, Hubbard & Reed, New York, New York.
New York. Welcome to Virginia. Glad to have you.
I'm very glad to be here. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case turned on three disputed factual issues, the first of which were identified by Justices Mim and Justices Kelsey very astutely during the questioning of the appellant. The first disputed issue of fact is, what was the capital N nuclear, capital T technology that was exclusive to ARIPA? Because that is foundational for all of the claims. And it included not just the enormous list of activities that were described in the 1991 agreement, Justice Mims, it also included the TVA amendment that was entered into in 2003, which was 8520 of the record, when Your Honor.
So your position is that everything on pages 110, 111, 112 of the 1991 agreement is exclusive?
No. Your Honor is correct that the exclusive provisions that were pertinent to the trial below were those set forth in 8.1.1A, 8.1.1B, this is on page 110, and also 8.1.6, which was added by amendment to the agreement under the 2003 settlement. And 8520 of the record that Your Honor read from is actually an excerpt from the TVA agreement Exhibit B.
Okay.
And the way that came into the case was in the settlement of litigation in 2003, there was an agreement in which ARIPA paid $10.5 million for, among other things, the exclusive rights that were defined on that page, which the language of which is very relevant to the questions Justice Kelsey was asking, because it granted a non-exclusive, an exclusive license to make, use, sell, design, and take any other action other than manufacture of heavy components. So,
for any and all contracts, or that one particular contract?
This particular provision applied only to verdict contract number one, the TVA contract 150T.
Doesn't that substantially limit the argument? It's only the TVA exception to the exception.
No, because, well, as to this one,
right.
As we say in our brief, the parties' rights were different from one contract to the other. But this one is the one that I thought was the clearest, because under the parties' agreements, any work pertaining to TVA...
putting aside TVA as the anomaly, and clearly it is in the list of contracts, all the other contracts are still governed by 8.13.
Absolutely correct.
And 8.2, which incorporates the coordination agreement. Coordination agreement exempts entirely change-outs of heavy equipment.
Your Honor...
So is there anything wrong with the logic so far?
Yes, there is, because if you would turn to pages 13393 of the record, which is the relevant provision of the coordination agreement, I believe Your Honor is misreading the agreement.
Okay.
Section 5.05B of the agreement specifically provides in the third sentence, B&W has no right now or in the future to use any technical assistance licensed on or before the date of the second closing by B&W to BWNS on an exclusive basis as to B&W or any technology sold by B&W or its affiliates to Framatome, SFI, or BWNS. So, contrary to the suggestion that was made by appellant for the first time in its opening brief, in this case in a footnote, it was very clear that the expiration of the non-compete provision, which is what this is, did not entitle the defendants to use the technology that was exclusive. So that was specifically prohibited by 505B. And then in the provision that they cite on the next page, 505F, there is this further provision that says, subject to whatever restrictions on their use of the technology may exist at the time. So yeah, when the non-compete came off, they could engage in competition for, say, non-OTSG plants, but as to the fleet of OTSG plants, the technology agreements were unlimited in duration and did not elapse. So the argument that was made in that brief by the appellants was incorrect.
Okay, let me stop you for a half second. The 1991 restatement says such license will be non-exclusive with respect to any activity B&W undertakes in exercising its rights to compete pursuant to 5.05F of the coordination agreement.
Correct.
So explain again how the 91 agreement does not eliminate the exclusivity for changeouts.
Because it provides in 505F, subject to whatever restrictions on their use of the technology may exist in the agreements between. So what we have are a series of contractual restrictions. They may not use the licensed capital N nuclear capital T technology to engage in various activities that all of the utilities require be delivered as part of a contract like all of the contracts listed in the agreement. So I believe that Your Honor is incorrectly interpreting that agreement.
So the 8.1.3, the develop, design, sell, manufacture, design, heavy components, etc.
8.1.3?
Right. Of the 91 restated agreement.
Yes.
As I understand your logic, the logic would require that any nuclear technology that Areva acquired through its contractual privity that's incorporated into the manufacturing process will ultimately be applied at the site when it's plugged in. Is that overly broad?
I believe that is an oversimplification, Your Honor. I think this is why I started with a capital N, capital T technology. If you look at section 1.13 of the agreement, which is on page 82 of the appendix volume we're talking about, there is a list of licensed products and services, capital L, capital P, capital S. And that is significant because licensed products and services is in the license grant in the March 19, 2004 agreement. And you'll notice that you have, among other things, in 1.13C, nuclear reactor engineering services. Those were Areva exclusive technology to perform nuclear reactor engineering services. And what Mr. Getchell dismissed as the insignificant contracts, they all fell within the bullseye of nuclear reactor engineering services, which is a tell that their argument is not valid in terms of what it means to make use of technology, what customers are buying. So the first thing that Areva owned was nuclear reactor engineering services. That was one of the things that they got under the March 2004 license agreement. The second one was 1.13E, specialized nuclear maintenance, inspection, and field services. B&W's argument to the jury and the argument to this court amounts to a contention that the only thing that they got was the right to perform field services. Unless someone actually is in the field at the plant, it's impossible for the Areva exclusive technology to be used in a royalty-bearing way.
No, can I interrupt you there? Because I'm confused by that last statement.
Okay.
The at the plant is a filter for the royalty on the sublicense. So it's entirely logically possible, if you set the Venn diagrams up, to have an exclusive nuclear technology that is Areva's exclusive and thus pass through the first hurdle but not be used at the plant for purposes of triggering the royalty. But it seems like you're conflating the two, unless I'm misunderstanding.
The testimony at trial was that within the United States, those two provisions were congruent. The appellant's own witness, Thomas Christopher, who testified for the appellants at trial, testified consistently with common sense in the language that if you are using Areva exclusive technology, you owe a license. It is not a rational interpretation to say that the license grant is this big, but the royalty obligation is this big. Mr. Christopher and
so
Mr. Beam.
Did that also apply to contracts 1, 2, and 3 on the verdict form?
Of course, because those contracts were not, quote, manufacturing contracts. The difference between this case and cases where contract construction is a pure question of law is we're dealing with nuclear industry terms of art. And what are the boundaries of functional design as opposed to evaluation of nuclear reactor systems was a subject of conflicting testimony at trial. And the testimony at trial was that each and every contract on this verdict included a sale of nuclear reactor engineering services. Customers won't buy a component that is unaccompanied by the documentation needed to permit the plant to restart following reconstructive surgery. So to the narrative that has been told in the brief that there was a complete separation of the businesses and that the retention of a fabrication facility meant that they had some completely unfettered right to compete against Areva in the nuclear commercial services business is simply not correct. Providing a replacement component is a commercial nuclear service. Providing an engineering analysis is a nuclear commercial nuclear service.
May I interrupt you one more time?
Yes.
Putting aside the thematic narratives that often accompany the briefs, if you just read, none of us are nuclear engineers, and contracts should be written for the legal mind, not for the nuclear
Correct.
Scientist mind. If you read this literally, it seems quite conspicuous that the royalty is limited to a certain apparently narrow aspect of this exclusive technology, use performed at site. And an ordinary person would say, okay, you're there. You're not making it in Canada and putting it on a gigantic 18-wheeler and sending it down someplace. So at some point, and the trial judge pretty much in summary judgment got to this point, at some point the lawyers and judges have got to put meaning on the words and then give that to the jury to figure out the facts. We don't generally allow the juries to interpret contract meaning. So why is that language not what it plainly appears to mean?
When Your Honor just was characterizing it, Your Honor inserted the word performed. The word performed is not in Section 2A of the agreement.
It's in Section 2D of the agreement, which is an application of subsection 2A.
2D, well, 2D talks about projects performed, but it doesn't prescribe that the work must physically be done at the site. The interpretation, the construction rule that has to be applied here is we have to give effect to all the provisions of the agreement, and we have to make sense of the agreement as a whole. And what we have here is a situation in which, among other things, B&W got a sublicense to perform all of the nuclear reactor engineering services, which included things the testimony held, were not retained by B&W. Why did B&W enter into the MCATS agreement in 1993? Well, there's two possible inferences from that. This was the agreement where shortly after they completely divested themselves of the business and the last of the $128 million was paid, and suddenly they had to compete in the business. What did they do? They didn't compete independently. They entered into a contract with Areva in order to prepare bid proposals. Preparing bid proposals is a kind of activity that they had divested themselves of any legal ability to do. So they actually hired Areva to submit to prepare their bid proposal to Duke for the ONS nuclear station because the customer had requested that. This was something that a bidder would have to prepare and do. So the history here is that the parties had separated their business, yes, but all B&W had was a fabrication facility, and they needed Areva in order to participate in this business. What they got in 2004 was, for the first time in 15 years, the ability to compete with Areva head-to-head in this business and to engage in contract activities. I mean, the small contracts are the real tell because under their theory, they would never owe any royalty under the license agreement. It was just a free license. And that's not what the testimony was. The testimony was you have to say, how do I know if a contract requires use of the technology at the site? I'm delivering a component that may embody hundreds of independent trade secret innovations, and it's being delivered to the site for use at the site. And the contract specifically authorized B&W, notwithstanding the confidentiality provisions, to transfer the nuclear technology to the customers. So there's no question but that each of these contracts required more than manufacturing. They required more than component design. They required more than functional design. They called for even field services, even every single, even under the narrowest possible interpretation of the agreement. Take the Davis-Besse contract. They had to warrant that the replacement generators not only would be subject to operation in the plant without a license amendment, which required nuclear reactor engineering services that they had no right to perform prior to 2004, but they warranted that they would deliver 52 degrees Fahrenheit of superheat for a certain period of time, and if they didn't, they'd have to come back and fix them. So the contracts unquestionably required...
Did they come back and fix it?
Well, the contract required them to do so, and the royalty trigger is not what might have happened 10, 15 years down the road. It's what the contract required. The contract also required field services to assist in startup. Again, right at the core of even under the narrowest conception of field services being the scope of the right. So in order to interpret this properly, you have to be able to tell, it's like with a complaint, an insurance coverage on a complaint. You look, what are the allegations of the complaint? What does it allege? And then we decide whether or not it falls within a coverage or not. It's the same thing here. You have a contract. What does the contract require the defendant to do? And in this case, all of these contracts on their face required all kinds of activities which are described to a T. In this technical language, you know, perform transient analysis. You know, transient is a nuclear industry term of art that describes something like a main steam line break, MSLB, or a loss of coolant accident, LOCA. And you can't do that. You can't do that kind of analysis without making use of long ago created mathematical models so that for regulatory purposes, you can guarantee that after this reconstructive surgery, or after this failure, or after this foreign material in the plant, that the plant can safely operate without a license amendment. So, all of these contracts, on their face, required use of the Technology Act, and that was true both with respect to delivering the deliverables for engineering reports. The testimony was reports embody the technology. The testimony was the components embody the technology, as we all can understand. And indeed, they even required people physically to go and do corrective work, which under Section 1.19 of the list of nuclear reactor engineering services was something that fell within AREVA's exclusive domain, and to perform field services associated with startup, which again...
Now, counsel, if we concluded... contrary to your reading of this contract, that there actually had to be a B&W presence on site in order for this royalty to apply, which of these contracts actually satisfy that requirement other than Duke Energy?
The contracts on their face, I believe that TVA, Davis Bessie, Crystal River 3 contracts 1, 2, and 3. I believe the Hot Lakes contract also.
Did your witnesses testify that there was never a presence on the site other than at Duke Energy?
What the witnesses testified to was that the contracts required use of the technology at the site.
But when the question was specifically asked as to which of these sites B&W had actually performed work, was the testimony that they had not performed at any of the sites other than Duke Energy?
I don't think our witnesses knew the answer to that because we weren't privy to what B&W actually did or whether it used subcontractors or third parties to perform the work. I mean, under the interpretation that apparently is being put forward, they could evade the royalty obligation through subcontracting and some third party would come to the site.
Well, counsel, putting that aside, just to follow up on Justice Powell's question, was there any evidence that a B&W, any physical B&W personnel performed work on any of the sites in the contract?
There was testimony that they did do that they actually came to the Duke Oconee sites in performance of the agreement. And I'd like to mention that there is no issue in this case about whether or not that 2D payment might have excused a 4% royalty on a contract entered into in 2004. There is no issue in this case. The testimony on that was basically an ante and upfront payment that had to be paid in order to prevent the license from expiring. And this idea that a payment made in 2004 excused a royalty on a contract made in 2010 was never made until about 3.5 years into the litigation. It contradicted the contemporaneous correspondence.
Are you talking about the Duke contract for nuclear steam generation inspection maintenance services?
That is the contract number 14 on page JA-361.
Which company was the B&W company that was the contractual
the,
party?
The party to that contract, I'm after my time, may I answer your question?
Absolutely.
Yes. The party to that contract was B&W Nuclear Energy, Inc., and throughout the trial and throughout the case, the appellants took the position that they were a permitted sub-licensee under the license agreement and were governed by the license agreement. But then at trial, they took the position, well, only the grantees are the ones that have the license agreement. So they were taking inconsistent positions, and the complaint alleges alternative theories on this. And so the plaintiff's position on this was that if they're right, that they received a sublicense from the actual grantees and we chose to condone it, well, then they would be subject to the 4% royalty on that. On the other hand, if the jury bought their trial argument that only the two grantees were parties, then they could award the same damages on a misappropriation theory. And I would say, finally, my time is over.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron.
Mr. Getchell.
Justice, that's the reason I was reluctant to say that even A, B, and I were exclusive is exclusivity is within the Areva's field of use. So that if we're doing the same thing within our reserved a right to design, manufacture, and sell ROTSGs, then it's not exclusive in that sense. So I didn't want to create a confusion on that point.
Okay.
There seems to be a lot of the questions we've been asking in your replies. We're missing just the middle ground, which is shared technology. Neither side has exclusive use.
Right, and we admit that there's shared technology on the component and functional design. It was non-exclusive with respect to Areva, but we had the only right to build ROTSGs, and so in that sense, it was when we were using it for that purpose, it was exclusive to us. So exclusivity, depending on the field of use, becomes a slipperier term than it otherwise should be. They tried to carve out TVA. Remember, TVA had a provision that no royalty was owing unless it was completed. The evidence was it was never completed. They say the testimony was the $250,000 was not royalty on the first contract. The testimony they're relying on was incoherent and is contrary to the express terms of the agreement. And I commend footnote 34 in our opening brief to your attention as to containing the citations where they admitted that they had no knowledge of work at the site by B&W.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.